Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today, as we approach the new year, we'll examine one of the stories that sadly, in many ways, will define 2014, the rash of police shootings and the protests that have erupted across the country in response to a perception that there is no justice for black victims shot by white policemen and that we are far from a colorblind post-racial society. We'll begin with an interview on August the 14th, when protests were erupting in Ferguson, Missouri, following the shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a white policeman. Bree Carlson, the director of the Structural Racism Program for National People's Action, joins us to discuss the deeper structural, racial, and economic issues at play beyond the headlines. Then we'll speak with Elizabeth Beavers, the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, who has been lobbying Congress for the past year to block the Pentagon's handout of surplus military weapons and hardware to police forces across the country, known as the 1033 program, that has resulted in the streets of Ferguson looking like a war zone. We spoke to Elizabeth on August the 17th of this year. Then we'll go to an interview I did on November the 25th, 2014, with Vanilia Randall, Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio, and the author of Dying While Black. We examined the sham and charade that was presented by the prosecutor who declined to indict the policeman who shot Michael Brown, and looked into the extent to which the fix was in from the beginning with a police-friendly prosecutor whose apparent aim all along was to exonerate Officer Wilson. Then finally, earlier this month, on December the 4th, we spoke with Eko Yanka, a professor of law at the Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University. He joins us to discuss another failure of a grand jury to indict a white police officer for killing a black man, in this case an NYPD policeman who used an illegal chokehold, strangling a man to death in an incident that was recorded on video by a bystander. Yet the grand jurors who saw the same video as the rest of the world did declined to indict the NYPD officer. And joining us now in the studio is Bree Carlson, who is the director of the Structural Racism Program for the National People's Action, a network of community organizations using direct action community organizing across the United States to advance racial and economic justice. Working in the racial justice field for more than 15 years, her experience includes community, labor, and electoral organizing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bree Carlson.
Thank you.
So, Bree, is what's happening in Missouri, in Ferguson, Missouri, north of the northern part of St. Louis, is that a manifestation of structural racism?
Absolutely. Structural racism is a different way of looking at racism. In the United States, we tend to think of it as individual incidents. So there must be an evil cop involved, a bad person who hates black people, rather than thinking of a set of circumstances that create a pattern of police killings of African Americans across the country.
So let's start with the economic condition. My understanding is that this area is almost a lot like Detroit in terms of urban blight. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding as well, yes.
So fairly systemic poverty. This neighborhood is two-thirds African-American, yet the council that represents it, four of the five council members are white Republicans. There's only one African-American on the local council. And the police who police this neighborhood, I believe there are over 50 policemen in Ferguson Police Department. I think out of the 50-plus, there's only, three or four African-American?
Three.
So there you have an enormous disparity. What explains that, do you think?
You know, there are a number of things that could produce that in one city. What I think is interesting is that it's a fairly egregious example of representation being completely different than the racial makeup of the city. That said, it's not actually unusual in the United States for black folks, for African Americans, to be underrepresented. We are underrepresented at the federal level. We are underrepresented in states across the country and in cities across the country. So while that is useful in thinking about how this could happen, the idea that a police force wouldn't racially match the demographics of the city or that a city council wouldn't racially match the demographics of the city is actually much more normal than it is unusual.
And how pervasive is it across the country that you have police forces? You know, the motto here in Los Angeles is protect and serve. So you protect and serve your community. This seems to be the mentality in Ferguson, Missouri, and perhaps in other, lots of places across the country. It seems to be the opposite. You're not protecting the community. You're hostile towards them. You're almost like an occupying army. You see them as not people that you want to protect and serve, but people that you want to, you know, either oppress or certainly keep in line.
Mm-hmm. And it has more to do, I think, with the community in question than it does with the dissonance in the story we tell. You know, the police are your friends. They are there to protect and serve. They are part of the communities that they're working in. There are probably communities across the country where that is true. So there are a lot of people across the country for whom that is true in their experience. I live in Lincoln Heights, which is just a little bit north and east of downtown, and an area that I'm told has a long history of pretty intense gang activity. And that's, you know, a part of the truth of my experience living there. But I saw a year or so ago the police chase a car that had apparently been stolen by a couple of teenagers, an old car, chase it down a hill. And in pursuit of that car, they, and this is a very narrow residential street on a hill, and they forced the car to speed up going down the hill and then rammed it so that it crashed into, at the corner, it crashed into a house, which pushed the car in the parking lot in front of the house through the wall. And inside that house, there's a family that I know. And, you know, they have a small child that's a baby. They have several other children, all of whom were just sitting in the living room watching TV with no idea this is going on. Then the police from every direction just sort of swarmed the area and came out with shotguns trained on these kids who had stolen the car to pull them out of the car. They jeopardized the lives, not just of the kids in the car, but also the people in the house that they rammed a car through, all in pursuit of people who stole a car, teenagers who stole a car. I imagine that happens in neighborhoods across the country, but how the police respond to it is different based on what they think about the people who live in that neighborhood. And it was clear to me that the people who live in Lincoln Heights were less fully human somehow in the eyes of the police, because it was okay to put people in that kind of danger to stop a vehicle theft.
But Bree, it would seem to me that the difference, you know, here with LAPD, for example, and then Ferguson, Missouri, is simply that this police force is clearly doubling down on stupidity. I mean, the way they attacked members of the press and fired tear gas at Al Jazeera, you know, that is public relations savvy police forces would realize that you don't kill the messenger, because then you end up with a bad message. And the message itself was bad enough in the first place. Now, we don't really know about the actual critical moment of what happened with this young African-American 18-year-old who was clearly shot multiple times facing the policeman with his hands up. That seems to be the consensus of eyewitness reports. The earlier part where the police car comes by, apparently this fellow is well known to the community. The fact that the police won't release his name is somewhat irrelevant, that the local people know him, because he's apparently a serial harasser. So he drives along in the police car, opens the door and slams these two kids with the door, somehow pulls the young man into the car. Something happened at that critical moment. Mm-hmm. A gunshot was fired. The kid ran, and then he was shot in the back by this policeman, and then he turned with his hands up and was shot another, I think, five times and dropped dead, and they left him on the sidewalk for hours. So what difference will it make, do you think? Whatever. I mean, now the police are saying this fellow had some, the policeman has some facial wounds or something. That critical moment, is it possible that what happened was something, an altercation took place and the policeman simply just saw blood, was just enraged? But my understanding is that that is a privilege that policemen don't have, that that kind of impulse is trained out of them, that they're not supposed to be vigilantes or respond in that kind of animalistic way.
It's my understanding that the training is supposed to produce the result that police officers wouldn't act out of fear, wouldn't act out of rage, but are trained to sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, ground themselves and make rational decisions about how they respond. But my understanding doesn't appear to hold true. I mean, just looking at the sheer number of incidents of police killings, and the number that are on videotape, the number that we just see on the internet, that we see on television. You know, I can't breathe while a police officer is choking someone to death, police officers beating people on the sides of highways. And it can't possibly be true that the training police are receiving is producing the result we're told it does.
So, I mean, obviously you have to attribute this to a lot of factors, but let's start with at least the idea that we are increasingly living in a kind of ghettoized America, you know, where the wealthier people are living behind gates with the private security forces, and then you've got pockets. I mean, this city, by the way, I mean, a lot of it is, I think, attractive and interesting. The fact that there's a Koreatown, there's a Japantown, there's a Chinatown, there's an Indiatown, you name it. That's all, I think, a wonderful manifestation of a kind of melting pot. But there's also this idea that there are parts of the city that you simply don't go if you're white, or conversely, if you're black, because you're likely to get arrested.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The part that is important to understand here, which I think largely will not be discussed again, is this pattern. So we can look at Ferguson, and I imagine that the story as it goes forward will continue to make it a more and more isolated incident with incidents with special circumstances. Something about the demographic of the community, the blight in the community, the particular incident and what that officer was or wasn't thinking, and the character of that officer along with the character of the man who was shot. But when you take all of that away, there is this ongoing difference in the experience of people in this country based on their race, meaning if you are black or brown, if you are a person of color, or if you are just not white, that how you are interacted with the police, how you are represented in government, how you fare in school, how you fare in health outcomes will all be determined primarily by your race. And the story of how things happen, of education, of policing and the role of police, of how every institution is supposed to operate will still be based on the experience of a small group of white people. And so they aren't going to match up. And the job is, if we really want to find a solution, is to look at the patterns rather than look for the anomalies. The truth is, there's very little evidence to support that policing works the way we tell a story about it for communities of color. There's a tremendous amount of evidence to support that that is not at all how it works. But we make it about one bad police officer instead of looking at what is it about policing and the way that we do it that produces this consistent pattern of racial disparities, right?
So given that you've worked for 15 years with communities and over issues of community labor and electoral organizing, Bree Carlson, just give us some ideas, you know, without getting into too much detail because we don't have a lot of time, but about what can be done in terms of just ideas about better policing, mm-hmm. More social integration, more racial integration, more justice, essentially.
Absolutely. Well, at National People's Action, one of the roles I've had the great honor of playing is to help us figure out a 40-year agenda to change the economy. And a lot of people think it's strange that that's what I mostly focus on, given that I'm the director of the Structural Racism Program. But I actually believe that most of what we want to win around economic justice or change around conditions for communities that have to do with the economy is absolutely integrally tied to understanding race and racism. So that if we actually want to create enough jobs for people in this country across the board to be employed, for example, we have to get into the narrative or the stories that are told about why some people just don't deserve to work. And that has to do with how we think about racism. So we could have a huge scandal in this country about Paula Deen using the word nigger, and yet have very little comment around race when Paul Ryan, as he is developing the federal budget proposal, says that there are some urban communities, some urban people who are just living with a culture of not work or something, a culture of not right. wanting to work.
Blaming the victim mentality.
It's blaming the victim, but it's racialized. And mm-hmm. it's not particularly subtle. But because we talk about this problem like it's just bad individuals, you have to be so explicit that it is beyond question that the only possible thing you meant was to be racist because you hate a group of people. But the subtle stuff that actually creates a story that lives in the ether in this country, that is sort of seeps into us, that some people are just a little more lazy, a little bit more criminal, a little bit more likely to be a problem, or a little bit more to be feared, is what creates a whole different condition in some places, where the police, rather than being your friend, rather than defaulting to helping a citizen, will regard that citizen as a threat and shoot him without asking questions. If we can't get into that story and be willing to talk about it, willing to be honest about the difference, then every other measure that we take can be unmade by that story.
So, Bree Carlson, in terms of these communities themselves, given the nature of the crime of slavery in the history of this country, and one is reminded of Martin Luther King's famous statement that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, albeit slowly. What can be done in terms of, you know, you've made a very clear case of how all of us are culpable in a way, but in terms of the people who are most impacted, like the people of Ferguson, Missouri, the two-thirds African-Americans in this community where they have a hostile police force and no real representation politically, what can this community do for itself?
Well, they are doing what they can now, which is to not be silenced, that they continue to show up to protest despite the fact that there's no question they're walking into violent situations and risking their lives. Is a big part of it. The other part is for all of us who are there in spirit, all of us who grieve for the loss of Michael Brown, to also be vigilant in pointing out that while this is a horrendous incident, it is not a remarkable incident. It is not an unusual incident, and that we have to ask for a solution that isn't about dealing with one police officer in one city, but with our understanding of policing in this country and why it is that we continue to collude in a system that tells a story about being one thing while it clearly regards, you know, people of color across this country as more disposable, less fully human, and less valuable than the people who are the citizens they imagine they're there to protect.
Well, just in closing then, Bree, we do have an African-American president and an African-American attorney general. On the surface, that's progress.
Well, either that or it's evidence to my point, which is that you can't imagine that adding a representative here or there is a real solution to a problem that is structural in that it is embedded in the way our institutions work. Nothing about racism in the United States requires anyone's intent one way or the other. We could take the most, you know, the people that we really think of as racist in our society, the most egregious, ugly, cross-burning, hood-wearing folks, and shoot them to the moon, and it wouldn't change a single thing that is happening, because it's not about a bad person or two. It's about systems that produce the result that they have always produced. And until we're brave enough to question the system rather than looking for the individual deviant, we aren't going to find solutions that actually change things.
Well, in this case, I guess we can hope that both President Obama and Eric Holder, as they've mentioned, they want a full and thorough investigation. And at the end of the day, if justice is not served here, we will have yet another outburst, will we not? I mean, this one's pretty flagrant. It's pretty hard to believe that there's not something wrong with an 18-year-old boy being with his hands up, surrendering after he's been shot in the back, being shot another five times in cold blood. That just doesn't sound right.
It's difficult. It doesn't. And I wish I could say that seemed unusual to me, but I have just seen too many, you know, this age of cell phones with cameras changes everything. And I've seen too many things that are so hideous that it's hard for me not to cry thinking about them. And none of them apparently were so outstanding or spectacular that they produced the level of justice that I think we're hoping is going to happen here. Have you seen the Twitter and Facebook things that I forget what you call them? I'm too old for this, but the if they gunned me down photo stuff,
right?
That people are showing images of themselves that where they come across as respectable, good 18-year-old boys, for instance, versus the ones where they look like the thugged out criminals that the police are seeing when they look at them. I think it's incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was provoked by the fact that the media used a threatening picture mm-hmm. of this young boy, and that contrasting it to pictures of white serial killers, you know, mm-hmm. Who look like they're choir boys, you know?
Absolutely, because we're all very surprised when that happens. And nobody is particularly surprised by any black or brown boy being a criminal.
Right.
So until we actually figure out how to expose that, you know, one thing that's helpful is to imagine that Ferguson were happening in the racial reverse. Imagine that in the United States somewhere there's a city that is 67%, 70% white, with a police force that is 53 officers, and actually I think it's two of whom are white and 51 of whom are African American. Imagine an 18-year-old white boy being shot, and imagine that that were part of a pattern. How we would look at it, what we would try to change, would be fundamentally different. I don't think that scenario is possible in the United States with all of the equal opportunity that we have. I don't imagine that that's possible. But if it were, there is no one in this society who would tolerate it because it would be totally outrageous. There would be no question in anyone's mind that regardless of what that 18-year-old boy did, there was no case in which the police had any right to shoot him. But because we're talking about a black teenager and white police officers in a white-run city where the power is with white people, the assumption is that's probably not okay, but it must be one bad officer. And it might be okay if we can find any reason to justify it in this one child's history.
Well, Bree Carson, I thank you so much for joining us here today in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Bree Carson, who is the director of the Structural Racism Program for the National People's Action, a network of community organizations using direct action community organizing across the United States to advance racial and economic justice. Working in the racial justice field for more than 15 years, her experience includes community, labor, and electoral organizing. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the militarization of police in this retrospective on frayed race relations in America in 2014.
Families and the students all confused and hardy, weeping through each other's arms. It's murder. New absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. Shell shell like a bell and rung. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Beavers, the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She has an article at the New York Times with Michael Shank, Get the Military Off Main Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Beavers.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
And I was surprised to learn, Elizabeth, that you and your colleagues have been working on legislation for the last year on Capitol Hill, lobbying lawmakers to stop this 1033 program that was enacted by Congress in 1997 to dispense extra military gear to police forces across the country. And, of course, we've seen manifestations of that. With the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, looking like a war zone. So give us a sense of how the legislation is proceeding and whether it's going to get a bump from what's happening now.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, my organization, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, we're located right here in Washington, D.C., and we became aware of this program back in the fall and felt really concerned about it and sort of had this looming sense that something might happen, like has been happening in Ferguson, and we asked Congress to respond and to put some oversight over this program, which was sorely lacking at the time. And Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia stepped right up to the plate and has really been taking leadership and pushing for legislation and drafting language that would stop the transfer of the specifically military-grade weapons and machinery to the local police and also adding some oversight that didn't previously exist. So that's been in the works for a few months. We conducted a briefing a few weeks ago, actually. It was right before all of this happened. It was about a month ago at this point. We were joined by former police chief of Seattle, Norm Stamper, along with a representative of the ACLU. They just put out a great report on police militarization. They also have been looking at this program for a while and have been supportive of legislation. We're also joined by Radley Balco, who wrote the incredible book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, documenting exactly how this has been gradually happening. So, you know, it's a mixed feeling. We're glad that this issue is getting the attention that it deserves and hope that the bill will start getting some traction. But we're so very sorry for the circumstances that led to this attention.
And, of course, the circumstances keep changing all the time in Ferguson, Missouri. It's hard to keep track of what's been happening. And, of course, some of the reporting by nature of evolving events has been a little inaccurate. In fact, I had reported, as others had, that the policeman in question was well known to the community. And, of course, the police weren't releasing his name up until recently, and that he was allegedly as well-known to the community as a sort of serial harasser, and that turns out not to be the case. So it's difficult to follow this, but, of course, it's depressing to think that there has been the need for another curfew and looting has taken place, although the police do have a smaller footprint.
Yeah, that's right. It's been very difficult to keep up with the changes. It's a rapidly expanding situation, and developments are always coming up. And I think what a lot of the changes have shown us is exactly what my organization and many others have been saying for quite a while, which is that when you employ these militarized tactics, it tends to ignite pre-existing tensions that have been sort of lingering under the surface for quite a while. There's racial disparities there. There's all sorts of implications for why that tension exists. But then once police come in basically with guns blazing, with tank-like structures and pointing guns at citizens, it escalates the tension. It doesn't de-escalate, which is supposed to be the goal for crowd control. And especially when we saw in the last couple of days Captain Ron Johnson taking over and the State Highway Patrol replacing St. Louis County and sort of governing the situation, we saw police coming out, walking the streets, embracing some of the protesters, asking them what they were there for, speaking with them, engaging with them as if they're humans, not as if they're the enemy. Suddenly you see a lot of calm, you see a completely de-escalated situation, and it's been like night and day is what they said, which is exactly what many critics of this program have been saying, that you can't defend having these sorts of weapons and machinery due to needing them to control crowds or something of that sort, because it doesn't control the crowds. It escalates and it ignites things that were already there. So we're glad to see some of the tensions de-escalating. We hope with the new curfews that the peace continues, because you know, it's sort of the slogan of my organization that war is not the answer, and we typically mean that internationally, but the truth is it's the case domestically as well, that you know, the shooting, everything that happened, responding with a military first tactic is not the way to go. And the funny thing is that these exact same weapons of war that were designed to withstand, you know, landmines and explosions overseas, they're right here in Main Street now. So the exact same policies we've been using internationally, unchecked military, unchecked war, it's coming home now into an unchecked military presence in the streets, and that's something that absolutely has to change, which is why we're supporting Congressman Johnson's bill.
And it does seem obvious, Elizabeth, that the police are there to police communities as opposed to wage war against them with military equipment. And the very presence of military equipment suggests an attitude that the citizens of the community are the enemy, as opposed to people that you're supposed to protect and serve. So tell me, though, about the extent to which this 1033 program from the Pentagon, which allows for surplus military equipment to be given to police departments across the country, and it's led to this militarization of police. Apparently, a part of the program, a condition of getting this equipment, is that you've got to use it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And so what you're referencing there, for your listeners, it's the 1033 program. It was enacted by Congress in 1997. And it basically just says that the Department of Defense can transfer its surplus equipment, whether new or used, to local police, to local law enforcement agencies at no cost. So you've got all 50 U.S. states, four U.S. territories are recipients of the program. They've given out nearly $5 billion worth of equipment ever since this program has come into existence, and it's led to the formation of more SWAT teams. It's led to exactly the kind of responses we've seen at Ferguson, and exactly what you said there, that one of the regulations is that you're supposed to use the equipment within 1 year, and if you don't need it, you're supposed to give it back, but that's not usually what happens. Usually they hang on to it, and they have it sort of indefinitely, and when they have it, they want to use it, even if it wasn't a regulation. I think that's just common sense, that when you have a new toy, you want to play with it. And so in the absence of violent crime or extremism, what we're seeing is they're sending out their SWAT teams for low-level drug raids or to execute search warrants or other sort of run-of-the-mill everyday policing activities, and that completely escalates other situations and has led to a completely militarized force, a show of force, whenever there's just routine law enforcement that's supposed to be being done. Another problem I want to highlight that hasn't gotten a lot of coverage is that, there's the obvious problem of militarization through the 1033 program, but there's also this huge element of waste, fraud, and abuse, which is that when local law enforcement are receiving these items, they can't always account for them later on. And they're supposed to be keeping a really detailed inventory, but there's not really anybody looking after that. So there are all these cases of police trying to sell the weapons, trying to lend them to unauthorized friends, losing them. There's a report of a Humvee being unaccounted for. A law enforcement official in my home state of North Carolina pled guilty to selling over $30,000 worth of M16s on eBay that he had received through the program for free. So it's kind of become a free-for-all, and it's a really dangerous weapons flow that it's the second part of this bill that the congressman's been working on, is to put some oversight in there and track, okay, once people have these things, what are they doing with them and where are they? It's just sort of they've been given this privilege of having free equipment, and there should be some responsibility that comes with it.
Well, there's nothing more disconcerting than having weapons pointed at you, and it normally happens in combat. It's not supposed to happen on the streets of America. The people that are pointing the weapons at you should not be the people who are supposed to protect and serve, as opposed to the enemy. And when you see these pictures of the police pointing their guns and snipers, police snipers, sighting people through their scopes, it does make you wonder whether many of the police forces across the country have forgotten their basic duty, which is to defend and protect life, not to take life. And the idea that they have a license to kill that is being abused is truly, it's frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our friend Norm Stamberg talks about the utilization of militaristic tactics in Seattle as one of the great mistakes of his life, and he talks about how it made the situation worse, and to respond in a more calm and de-escalating way is the actual way to promote peace and to promote security. And the police are not supposed to be soldiers or warriors. They're the community. They're all civilians. The community is supposed to be one of them. They're supposed to be part of it. And, Norm speaks so often about the idea of community policing and what law enforcement might look like if, as a cooperative, the community and the police together were working to protect one another and looking to promote law and order. And what would that look like instead of turning it into an us versus them battle every time? One would imagine, and we've kind of seen Ferguson from one day to the next, where the local militarized police were removed and the more community-oriented State Highway Patrol was put in. Captain Ron Johnson took over, and we see the difference of how the crowds responded and the more peaceful presence that existed after that. So I think we've seen Norm's theory in action in the last few days, and I think he might be correct, and hopefully people will start listening to that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Beavers.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Beavers, who's the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She has an article at the New York Times with Michael Schenck, Get the Military Off Main Street. And joining us now is Vernelia Randall, who is Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton in Ohio. Her writings are at her website, racism.org, and she is the author of the book, Dying While Black. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vernelia Randall.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously, the aftermath of what happened with this grand jury decision from the prosecutor, or at least announced by the prosecutor, who appeared to me to be more of a defense attorney of the accused, and the job of prosecutors and grand juries is to actually get indictments, not to defend the person who is supposed to be indicted. If anybody got attacked or in that presentation, it seemed to be the victim, Michael Brown. That's my impressions. What were your impressions?
That was my impression as well. And I think, to tell you the truth, from the very beginning, I teach race and racism in American law, taught it for 25 years. And I really didn't expect anything more than what happened from the point when he failed to indict to how he set up the grand jury process. There's a saying in the United States that a prosecutor can get a ham sandwich indicted if they want to. And so it's all about how you set up the process, and clearly he set up a process in order not to get an indictment, and then he defended that. He acted as a defense attorney in explaining that lack of an indictment.
So, in effect, the fix was in.
Yes.
So, what is your sense then of how, are there, in your experience as a professor of law, is there any examples where the police actually have been held to account?
The truth of the matter, in recent history, in the last 20, 30 years, there has been a significant change in how the law deals with police and police misconduct. And there has been one case where there was an indictment and then the judge threw that out. Police almost never even go past their department discipline. When they go before a grand jury, grand juries almost never indict them. And that's largely because prosecutors and police work together. And if the prosecutor doesn't protect the police, we have elected prosecutors. And in our society, prosecutors get elected by being tough on crime. They need police cooperation in order to be able to do that. And so prosecutors have an incentive to back police plays.
Now, you just mentioned bad police behavior and how this is obviously the lack of an indictment in the killing of Michael Brown, the unarmed teenager who was shot 6 times. This verdict, the lack of an indictment, is clearly not going to help improve police practices in Ferguson. And that, to me, was the whole missing element. And after all of the long presentation and the prosecutor talking about how many hours they'd worked and how diligent they were and how much evidence they'd sifted through and complaining about how eyewitness accounts differ as if that was a revelation. He never really described what really happened there. And my interpretation of what happened, just trying to read through the lines, is that the scuffle in the car where Michael Brown was shot in the thumb, where 2 bullets were discharged by the officer while he was still in his car, indicated that there was a serious scuffle. And my sense is that this policeman simply just was enraged. And he was in a white-hot rage pursuing this kid who apparently, you know, turned around and allegedly charged him. I have never heard of anybody charging somebody that's shooting 10 shots at you. Have you ever heard of anybody doing that?
No, and I think, you know, this is the problem with the system is set up. First of all of that is a defense. So, which is why I say the grand jury was set up. That would be a defense to a charge, not whether or not he ought to be charged. The question becomes, which is clearer, is whether his behavior taken in light, because this is what you're supposed to do, in light of the victim's viewpoint, whether there's enough evidence for an indictment.
That's the job that he should have done.
That's it. That's all you're supposed to look at.
Right, right. And he more or less did the opposite.
That's right.
Well, I find it extraordinary that there was, back in 2008, there was a whole sense in this country that the fact that Americans had elected their first African-American president was a sign of racial healing and progress. And yet, in many ways, the fact that this president has been so demonized and it's been open season on being able to hate him, as the Republicans do in the Congress, that's why we have broken government. It seems to be driven more by, the gridlock seems to be driven more by pure burning hatred than it does. It's reached a point of being irrational. So what's your sense then of how, do you think that in a way the election of Obama has sort of backfired? It's almost made racism acceptable, or hatred,
well,
at least
think,
hatred acceptable.
Well, I think that's true. I think, as a person who felt that Obama did not bring a good history for addressing racial justice, I've been significantly disappointed in him, and even in terms of his reaction to the lack of indictment. I think what has happened, and this is not unusual in anybody who understands race relations. I've been a first all my life. I'm 70 years old, and in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed when I was a young adult. And so every major job that I have, I've been the first. And one of the things that always happened to the first is backlash from the people in the environment who believe that you don't deserve it, that you shouldn't be here, that their racism come out. So the backlash to Obama was clearly predictable. I mean, it would have been surprising if it hadn't happened.
Right.
But the other problem is people didn't see this. Many people, especially whites, and saw the election of Obama as a sign of their colorblindness. Oh, look how colorblind I am. I voted for Obama. So that means our society has moved to a point now where we don't have race problems. And so what has happened since the election of Obama is that the whole discussion of racism has turned on their head, so that if you try to talk about race and racism in American society, people attack you because they believe you are going against the fact that we are a colorblind society now, and that the election of Obama proves that we are a colorblind society. I do believe that as president, he is catching a lot of resistance and backlash to his presence. I think Obama has made that worse by trying to play it down instead of dealing with it head on and dealing with racial issues head on.
Well, it's particularly ironic when in that presentation by the McCulloch, the prosecutor in Missouri, that he went, I don't know how many times he invoked the name of Eric Holder, as though that they were working hand in glove. Did you notice that?
Yes. And I think that they may, the Justice Department, they're working with the Justice. I mean, it's clearly they work to set up the release and the I understand that the Homeland Security might have been in the area, that there was a coordination between the state and the Ferguson. I believe that his invoking the name of Eric Holder is the typical sort of, if I say a black man is involved in this, then I can't be racist, sort of thing. You know, sort mm-hmm. of like I have a black friend, so if I have a black friend, I can't be racist. If I'm working with a black person, Eric Holder, then this can't be racist.
Well, Vernelia Randall, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Vernelia Randall, who is Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio. Her writings are at her website, racism.org, and she's the author of the book, Dying While Black. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about another failure of a grand jury to indict a white police officer, which happened recently in the beginning of this month.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Echo Yunker, a professor of law at the Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University. He also serves on the executive board of the Innocence Project and the American Constitutional Society's New York chapter. And his publications include A Paradox in Overcriminalization and Good Guys and Bad Guys, Punishing Character, Equality, and the Relevance of Moral Character to Criminal Punishment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Echo Yunker.
Thank you for having me.
And I take it that you're as mystified as I am that the grand jury in Staten Island failed to indict the police officer who used a banned chokehold on Eric Garner, causing his death, which the medical examiner ruled was a homicide, and yet the whole thing was videotaped by a bystander. It seems so clear. It's as though we're in an alternative universe.
This has been absolutely stunning. Even those of us who try to remain measured in the face of depressing incident after depressing incident, we often remember our lawyerly training. We swallow hard and we say, well, it's about reasonable doubt. In this case, not even reasonable doubt, just probable cause. But we think to ourselves, we weren't there, we didn't see what happened, there are two sides of every story. And of course, then we cry the lament that we'll only ever hear one side of the story. In this case, there was a real sense in which we were there. Nobody pretends that videotape is perfect or shows all angles, but it's just impossible to deny that we were all witnesses to this in an important way. And for a grand jury to look at this videotape and see no probable cause for any crime has been not just dispiriting, but just startling, absolutely startling.
Well, when you were saying that the attitude or the apparent attitude of the police is that they're sort of an occupying army in an unfriendly territory rather than members of a community who they are serving, the Justice Department just came out today with a damning report on the Cleveland Police Department and many of the outrageous shootings, car chases, etc., that have gone on there recently. And, of course, only a week or so ago, a young, I think he was like a 12-year-old boy, was shot dead by a police officer in Cleveland because he had a toy air pistol, which was mistaken for a handgun. But in this Justice Department report, it points out that at the Cleveland Division of the Police District Station, in one of Cleveland's police district stations, there's a sign that hangs up reading Forward Operating Base, which implies, of course, that that station is in a war zone.
Yeah. I mean, what is true is that over the last couple generations, the police have become increasingly militarized. It's hard to know this if one isn't interested in the history of these things, but police forces were not always the way they look now. Certainly the modern police force is a new invention as we urbanized some 100 years ago. And we, for some reason mysteriously decided that the model is going to be the military. So we have sergeants and we have forward bases. When one thinks about what that says about the relationship between police and citizen, it strikes me as incredibly dangerous. And on your point about young Mr. Tamir Rice, who is shot, you know, again, I'm sympathetic that when a police officer approaches somebody with a gun that's indistinguishable from a real gun, they are now in a position where they're going to shoot. That seems, we know that police officers are in incredibly dangerous positions. But a question we have to ask is why the police officer had to escalate the situation to where the only choice was going to be a fatal choice so quickly. So the video shows that he drives up. He's apparently yelling to the 12-year-old, hands, hands. He views the 12-year-old as a full-grown man, a full-grown threat. And there's literally 2 seconds between when the officer arrives at the scene and when he shoots this person, when he shoots this boy. It's hard to imagine that if we thought of this young man as somebody we valued, somebody who is one of ours, if we could see him, his humanity, if we could see a 12-year-old cute blonde kid who is misbehaving, that the first thing we would do is load the situation in such a way that the choices are going to be fatal.
And this police officer had not been on the job very long, and I believe he's certainly been suspended, has he not?
That's right. He was declared unfit for duty in 2012. And I think it was because his handling of his weapon was found unsatisfactory.
Well, this gets to, I guess, training. But when you combine these events like Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland, what they all seem to have in common is that you don't really, and particularly in these grand juries where you never get to trial, so you don't really know how the defendant is being examined or judged. But in the case of Ferguson, it seems so obvious to me that Officer Wilson simply just lost it and in a blind rage because this Michael Brown kid had hassled him in his car and disrespected him. And it also, in the case that the Justice Department, in its report today on the Cleveland Police Department, in talking about this 25-minute car chase, these two teenagers, a young woman and her boyfriend, reached 100 mile an hour and ended up in the East Cleveland school parking lot. 13 officers surrounded the car and fired 137 rounds, hitting the two young joyriders, if you will, more than 20 times each. So again, it feels like, you know, this is a bad movie, that this is, you know, we've seen this stuff in movies and it's not supposed to happen. We're supposed to expect more from our police department. We know that they have a tense job and quite often they are harassed and provoked. But isn't the training supposed to sort of train that kind of adrenaline, testosterone reaction out of them?
Well, I think there's no question. Everything you said strikes me as important in terms of not just lamenting what's happened, but in terms of making real changes going forward. And I'll just say 3 quick things. The one is exactly what you said. We have to change the way that we train the police. I've been very pleased to hear Mayor de Blasio speak today about not just making one-off changes, but making structural changes and starting to change the way that police are trained in our precincts and through the academy. And part of that goes all the way to the roots, that police needn't be trained, that the only response to every situation is to exert domination. I think, secondly, there's no relieving our courts of their responsibility. So our courts, starting with our Supreme Court, have made it extraordinarily difficult to hold police officers to account. At every instance, the court has decided not only to ignore important conversations about race and policing, but to insulate police officers from liability, even under extraordinary circumstances, and to separate a police motivation from what they view as as a rights violation. And this means that there's an institutional lack of control about what we as a society want police to be doing and how we want to check them. But lastly, I think we're all quite responsible as citizens. So what's happened in the last few years is we have gone from respectfully understanding that the police have a difficult job and modestly and rightfully trying to listen to them and give them leeway as to what they need to do their job, to absolutely acquiescing to anything that a police department says is a necessary set of tools or a necessary set of actions they need to take. We cower when police say, you just don't understand what policing is like. And by the way, we do the same in prisons. We went from intelligently understanding that we should listen to those who know how to run prisons to absolutely acquiescing to when we see the most egregious abuses in prisons to some position like, well, the warden must know what he's doing. And we as citizens just can't do this anymore. We should be sympathetic and supportive of our police, but that does not mean abdicating our responsibility when we see what we know and should be committed to as bad policing to do something about it, to vote a certain way, to populate our citizen review boards, and to insist on accountability.
But in terms of, you just mentioned the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court has defined the kind of ambiguity that is at the heart of these incidents, both in Staten Island and Ferguson. They use the word reasonable, and it seems to be the reasonable force or a reasonable response on the part of the police is not based upon what we think, particularly those of us who saw the videotape, but apparently what police think in a similar situation, or at least what they would think in a similar situation. So is that the nub of it, that the Supreme Court have given the police this sort of enormous latitude about what is reasonable?
Well, I think it's a multi-layered set of problems, partly touched upon by what you say. Not only has the court decided that a police officer's action has to be reasonable, but indeed they've decided in a way that we don't decide in most other fields, that reasonable means that no reasonable officer, in a 2012 ruling, there was language to the effect that so long as any reasonable officer would have done X, then immunity is still held. This is quite an extraordinary view of what reasonable might be like. But additionally, the court has explicitly ruled that an officer's motivation will never affect, well, I shouldn't say never, will not affect for Fourth Amendment purposes the reasonableness of their search. So the fact that an officer, for example, is racially motivated to stop and frisk you doesn't affect whether or not a police officer can introduce any evidence he finds. And if you can somehow magically prove, as against the Supreme Court's law in another field, that the officer was racially profiling you, something that's going to be very difficult to prove, then you can bring a suit, a civil rights suit of a certain type, but you're not going to be able to suppress any evidence. So what that signals to the police is they can take their shot. They can just try, and maybe they'll get evidence, and nothing will, no matter what their motivation is, nothing will stop that from coming in. And, you know, and after all, if they don't find evidence, most people are furious, they're upset, they tell themselves they should do something, but most of us don't have the time or energy to pursue a lawsuit every time we're harassed by a police officer. So we grumble, we take the scar tissue, we're furious, but then we move on with our lives, and the police officer continues to behave this way. These are the many ways in which the Supreme Court has stopped building a system that rewards and encourages good policing and has constantly protected bad policing.
Well, Eka Yanka, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Eka Yanka, who's a professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.